It's our annual Year in Review, where we look back on some of the region's top stories of 2012. And joining us, Paul Pronovo, editor at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Josh Balling on the phone, managing editor at the Enquirer and Mirror on Nantucket. Morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Well, we start out with a really horrible story that happened in Connecticut, as we all are familiar with at this point, the shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. But has everybody here locally really kind of looking at what are our security plans for our schools?
This story was such a big deal, just to put it into a little bit of context. The Associated Press sends out in early December a list of what they consider the top like 100 stories of the year, and they ask editors to vote and help them create a top 10 list. After what happened at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, they, of course, said, hold on, we're sending a new set of stories because obviously this dramatically changes the picture. And we all know that what happened in Newtown, Connecticut is a story. It's the story of the year of 2012 and probably will be something that echoes for a long, long time to come. It's a tragedy that it's hard to even get your arms around. Mm-hmm. It's so significant, so gut-wrenching to even talk about. I mean, it's hard to even discuss. And yet it happened, and it's something that we as communities throughout the country have to deal with, have to confront, and we have to move past the emotion and start to talk about some of the practical aspects of it. And I think that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. I think obviously the first discussions are beginning, on at least on the local level, are beginning with the police departments and the school departments talking about what sort of security they have in place at their schools. And, you know, the good news is, probably all schools have a pretty high level of security. And, you know, this going back to Columbine, where this is something that was almost unprecedented. And now before Columbine, you could probably just sort of walk right into most schools. Well, you can't do that anymore, not even anywhere close. I mean, you typically have to be buzzed into a school, check in at the office and what have you. So those steps are in place. But of course, those steps were in place in Newtown.
Right.
So that's the sort of thing that school administrators and law enforcement officials are saying. Let's step back. Let's see what else we can do. What other protocols can we put in place? What are other sort of tripwires, symbolic tripwires, can we install to prevent something like this from happening? And how can we assure the public, parents in particular, that their children are going to go to school and they're going to be safe? And that's something that all parents, it's any time you put a kid on a school bus or you drop them off at the school, that's your greatest fear as a parent, is that will my child be okay in that environment in any way? Will they get sick during the day? Will they stub their toe? Never mind something as unspeakable as what happened in Newtown. So that's what we have to work our way through, and these very first steps are being taken.
You're right, Paul. I think it's also, though, it's the greatest fear, but it was also assumed for so long that putting your child on that bus, dropping your child off at school, that was a safe haven.
Yeah.
Regardless, you know, unfortunately for many families, what happened in the home or whatever circumstances were going on, school was a place where kids could be kids. And unfortunately, I think as we started learning in Columbine and then has continued on over the years and right here tragically in Newtown, that's not necessarily the case anymore. And, you know, parents and children of all ages are rethinking that. School administrators, police officers out here on Nantucket, those discussions began on Sunday morning, Saturday night between the police department and the school system as to how security could be improved, but at the same time ensuring that schools remain safe havens and remain comfortable for students, particularly younger students. So the discussions here largely centered around Nantucket Elementary School. And one of the things they set out here was that it's a balancing act between making sure that routines stay the same and that, particularly at the younger ages, children are still, you know, having fun learning and are encouraged to learn, encouraged to come to school, but maintaining that level of safety. And that's really the fine line we're going to have to walk moving forward into the future, I think.
And Josh mentioned it, you know, last week we talked about Chief Collins in Mashpee. They had a community meeting in Mashpee, about 50 parents came, and the chief said, you know, in my 32 years of law enforcement, I never expected to be having a meeting like this talking about elementary school security. And that's really one of the things that resonates. And here's another thing that resonates. I saw a cousin over the holidays who is a principal in Springfield, Mass. And he said, you ever notice that none of these things ever happen in cities? You know, in the cities you have violence, there's no doubt about it. But when you talk about a terrible incident like what happened in Newtown, it's in places that you would least expect violence to happen. And certainly that's, you know, we heard those reports about Newtown and the Sandy Hook district. You know, people move to that area to be part of that environment because of the schools. And so it's about the last place you would expect that to happen. And for us here on the Cape and the Islands, that means something because it's the same thing here. You know, this would be about the last place you'd expect something to happen, which is why you have to anticipate that it could.
Right.
And as Josh said, make sure that these places maintain that level of safe haven that they should be.
Right. Another big story this year, of course, was Superstorm Sandy. You know, we were battening down the hatches here. We got off easy compared to what happened in New York and New Jersey.
Right, we did. And in fact, you know, this was a storm. You know, there's a tendency sometimes to be complacent about weather events, if you will, and folks, because they've been sort of once bitten too shy a little too much. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, these storms are in the forecast, and they look devastating, and then it turns out to be a mild gust on a Saturday afternoon. But this one seemed to have all the hallmarks of something that people should prepare for, and they largely did. The Cape, fortunately, got through the storm pretty well. There was some serious erosion down here in the Falmouth area, along the Shore Road area, and also on the backside beaches. Saw some erosion, but frankly, not too much worse than you would have seen in a serious blizzard or a tropical storm. So, you know, that was the good news. The other good news was that in terms of emergency communication, in terms of power being restored, this went very, very smoothly. And when you compare the response, say, by the power company this year to last, and the couple storms we had, one in, I think it was around Labor Day, and then the other one in October, where power was out for some folks for a handful of days and other folks for up to a week, and no one knew what was going on. It was a real frustration, and not just here on the Cape of the Islands, but throughout the Commonwealth. Compare that to Sandy, and the response was quick, efficient. NSTAR was on top of things. Emergency personnel were crediting them with not only getting the power up, but also letting people know when it would come up.
Communication was much better. Yeah.
And so those are the positives to take away from that, although I think, again, we got lucky, comparatively speaking.
We dodged a bullet here on Nantucket as well, although there was some significant erosion, as Paul said, and we did lose a house and a garage onto the beach on the South Shore, where erosion has been an issue for quite a long time. We were looking at winds that topped out here around 85 miles an hour in some places. We had some scattered power outages as well, but nothing that lasted more than a few hours in most cases, and pretty much the town shut down on that Monday. Coast Guard had ordered the ports closed, so nothing was moving, no planes were flying, but again, as compared to New York, New Jersey Shore, some other places in Connecticut, we really dodged a bullet. What we got the following week was a nor'easter that was equally powerful and actually caused more damage than Sandy did. We had 11 boats washed ashore. An historic barn out at the Old Sconset Golf Course that's now owned by the Nantucket Land Bank came down right in the middle of discussions about how to restore that structure. There was some flooding. It was actually a storm that we come to expect on the island, but very powerful and not usually that early in the season, that actually coming on top of what we were dealing with Sandy, still cleaning up from some flooding and some erosion, a little bit of a 1-2 punch.
Right, yeah.
And you know, we talk about dodge a bullet. You look at the storm track, and if Sandy had tracked just even a little bit farther to the north, we would have been in big trouble.
Big trouble,
and
right.
If you look at what happened from the Jersey Shore, really the whole Jersey coastline, up into New York, into Staten Island, and around the bend, they got just absolutely wiped out. Mm-hmm. And we had, of course, the Massachusetts Maritime Academy's training ship, Kennedy, was drafted to go down and basically serve as a floating hotel for all the relief workers that poured into that area and did, you know, everything from, you know, make sure people were supplied to doing recon on houses, make sure people were okay. So they needed that sort of infrastructure of a place to stay, literally. So the boat was down there. We sent a couple staffers down, photographer Steve Heslip and reporter Doug Frazier, and they spent Thanksgiving with the relief workers to you know, see what it was like. You know, I think that at that point would have been 3, maybe even 4 weeks after the storm, to see what it was like. And they came back saying, you wouldn't even believe this is America. I mean, Staten Island was so wiped away. And you know, we grew accustomed to that in New Orleans a couple of years ago. You feel like the geography is part to play there and a lot of other factors. But when you think of Staten Island, New York, you don't think that houses are going to be literally wiped off the map or whole neighborhoods or huge fires that burn down, you know, a dozen houses. And they came back saying it's like a third world country. And I think you saw that same reaction from a lot of folks here who went there to help, and why you saw efforts continuing time and again to bring supplies down.
The photos were really interesting because there was that series of photos where, you know, what it was before and what it is now. Right. And boy, it was really dramatic.
You know, and a lesson, just a takeaway from it, I think for all of us, is that, you know, already they're asking, okay, now what? Do you rebuild? Do you really put houses in harm's way in the very same spot? And how foolhardy is that? Right. And that's the same sort of questions that, of course, we have to ask ourselves along our coast.
Exactly.
You know,
we're
the takeaway there, too, is that this is yet one more storm that was tracking toward the Cape and Islands that we managed to avoid. And next time that storm is tracking to the Cape and Islands, how prepared, not necessarily emergency preparedness, people who get paid to do this, but how seriously are we going to take it out here on Nantucket, on Cape Cod? Because we're just going to look back, many people, and say, oh, well, we missed Sandy, we missed the one before that, we missed Earl, we missed the one before that. Not necessarily a good attitude to have, but, you know, history speaks for itself.
Statistics, statistically, we're due, right?
We're way overdue.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Year in Review. We're talking with Paul Pronovost, editor at the Cape Cod Times, and Josh Bolling, managing editor at the Enquirer and Mirror. Well, early in 2012, the Mashpee Wampanoag announced their plans for a casino in Taunton, and what started out on the fast track now seems a little bit uncertain.
Yeah, when the casino legislation was passed, it seemed like the Mashpee Wampanoag had won. Because not only had casinos and advocates for casinos won the day, but the Mashpee Wampanoag had secured preferential treatment, if you will, down in southeastern Massachusetts. And this was something that they had negotiated with the governor. They'd been talking about for some time, and in fact, they'd been talking about casinos for some time. It was the Mashpee Wampanoag that really pushed this discussion forward in the Massachusetts legislature, because I think lawmakers realized once the Mashpee Wamps got federally recognized, the chances of building a casino increased dramatically. And I think the folks in state government said, we're going to lose out unless we figure out a way to be part of this. And already the discussions have been happening as people went to Connecticut and what have you. But once there was a tribe in Massachusetts that could do it, that really moved things forward. So they were able to work out a deal with the Mashpee Wampanoags where they essentially had the inside track for a casino in southeastern Massachusetts, one of three that they were going to locate sort of geographically spread out through through the state. And that was all good news. Things were tracking along. They had several benchmarks they had to hit, one of which was, I believe it was a July deadline to work out an agreement with the state, basically a compact on what the Mashpee Wampanoag would give and what the state would give to allow the Mashpees to have this right to have a casino in southeastern Mass. Unfortunately for the tribe, when they presented the compact, they hit their deadline. They presented it to the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the BIA said, this isn't fair. This simply isn't fair. The tribe is giving away too much, and we don't ratify this agreement. So now they have to go back to the drawing board. That's really bad news because it's almost like a space race when you're looking to build these casinos. Everybody wants in. Everybody wants to be first. Once you're up and established, you're in a very good position. So of course, any delay for the tribe is bad news in general. And then politically speaking, it's really bad news because now there was already an undercurrent of folks who felt that the tribe shouldn't have had an inside track, that southeastern Mass should be open to commercial developers. And in particular, New Bedford, which it looked like Mashpee wasn't interested in, they really fought it. And so now with this bump in the road, the tribe is losing a little momentum, and there's been talk about allowing commercial development in this area. Good news for the tribe, as we ended the year, the Gaming Commission said, you know what, we're not going to decide to allow commercial developers to look at this region quite yet. We're going to put that decision off till March. And essentially that bought the tribe time to work out their agreement. So that's where it stands now. They started the year you know, really racing out of the gates, and now they're ending it kind of stumbling, but maybe regaining their footing. And we're certainly going to find out a lot more in 2013.
Well, in April, the Barnstable County District Attorney Michael O'Keefe held a press conference to confirm that remains found in Falmouth were those of Trudy Hall. And Josh, this entire case has been such a mystery.
It really has, right from the beginning. And obviously, Trudy Hall was a young Nantucket woman who disappeared back in the summer of 2010 after heading over to the Cape. And it was quite some time before her remains were discovered. Michael O'Keefe made that announcement at that press conference. And still, there's all kinds of questions swirling around this one. The bones have been found. Foul play is obviously definitely suspected, a case of homicide, but no real suspects still, even after this, despite all kinds of investigations and questioning of some apparently prime suspects who were subsequently let go. Out here on Nantucket, Vivian Walker is Trudy Hall's mother, and then there's been a number of services and commemorations here on Nantucket for Trudy Hall. She maintained all along that something horrible had happened to her daughter, and she was unfortunately proven right. It's still being discussed out here, what happened to Trudy Hall, and as we move into the new year, we have some answers as to, she was finally found, but moving forward, it's really, it's still up in the air as to whether any justice will be done here or even any investigations will turn up anything.
And that's the thing. I mean, this, this case draws parallels to me with the Krista Worthington case. I mean, that case, first of all, lasted a very long time before an arrest was made. It looked like it was cold at many stages. Ultimately, they moved forward with that case. Here we are, we're sort of we're in what at least appears to be a cold stage. Now, we don't really know if it is. Right. I mean, we don't know what investigation is underway, where prosecutors are in this case. But because we don't know, it feels cold. All we know is that here was a young woman who mysteriously disappeared somewhere between Nantucket and the Cape. She's a person from Nantucket, but had connections here on the Cape as well. Then they found a rental car, and then there was a forensic evidence that suggested that something terrible had happened, and I believe her DNA was found in it, but no body had been found. So finding her remains is a huge step forward, you would think, in advancing this case. But what will it lead to? We don't know. Josh points out, there's been a lot of questions asked, a lot of people questioned. A lot of details about Trudy's life are curious, relationships she's had. And you wonder when, if at all, it's all going to come together. And again, getting back to the comparison with Krista Worthington, there are a lot of times where a lot of folks had doubts that it would ever come together. Right. And of course, we know it ultimately did. So that's the hope. You hope that there is justice for this young woman mm-hmm. who had been murdered. Mm-hmm. And we hope to find out what happens.
Right. Well, the scandal at the crime lab in Jamaica Plain created a lot of problems for many drug cases. And we're just scratching the surface at this point. Going to be a long time before we figure out exactly how many cases this involves.
Yeah, I mean, this is unbelievable. This chemist at the crime lab, Annie Dukin, they've identified about, I think, 60,000 samples taken from about 34,000 suspects, which is just extraordinary numbers when you think that potentially she fabricated and or tainted evidence. That's what they're trying to sort out, exactly what happened, why it happened, the magnitude of what happened. The evidence that she handled was involved in so many cases and was so critical to so many cases that what we have seen is prosecutors throughout Massachusetts and certainly here on the Cape and the Islands, prosecutors tossing cases, mm-hmm. letting people walk, people who had already been in jail, letting them walk out the door on any number of crimes. And, the law enforcement community is very, very upset about that. Just last week, Annie Dukin pled not guilty to a series of charges from evidence tampering to perjury charges. Her case will continue into this new year. We're still waiting to find out more why. Mm-hmm. Why did this happen? And there are any number of theories. People felt that she was a go-getter worker, maybe overworked, maybe there's some personal stresses associated with her life. But none of that seems to sort of get to why you would go this far and affect this many cases. We just know basically what the fallout is.
Right. Josh.
Out here on Nantucket, in another one of those sort of interesting quirks of island living. The Nantucket Police Department, the Nantucket investigators, did not use the Jamaica Plain Crime Lab. They used a different crime lab, a state police crime lab. So while prosecutors all over the Cape were struggling to figure out how many potential convicts would be walking free because of this, Nantucket got off scot-free. We don't have to worry about that out here. A while ago, a few years, there was some talk about consolidating the Nantucket evidence to the Jamaica Plain Crime Lab as well, and for some reason that didn't happen. So we're fortunate that there's one thing not affecting us this year.
Right, and that's, you know, Nantucket swimming against the stream is really good news for them, because remember that picture we had of Assistant District Attorney Mike Trudeau sitting in a room with one of his analysts with this huge pile of folders from cases and just going through them.
Each
and
one,
you know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're looking for Annie Dukin's name and seeing and putting those over in this pile. And so far, I think it's upwards of maybe close to 24 people who have been released, some of whom have been released and already bounced back to jail. Yeah. So it's really an amazing story.
It was a summer of shark and bear stories. The black bear arrived in June, creating quite a stir. Didn't make it to Nantucket or the vineyard.
Not that we know of, Josh. Keep your eyes out.
But it did pretty much cover the whole Cape, just about.
Yeah, I got to give credit to Eric Williams for coining the term a furry fortnight that the black bear spent on the Cape. And as you said, it walked essentially, maybe ran, maybe swam, the length of the Cape, like any good tourist would, you know, checking out all the sights, came on Memorial Day weekend and was an immediate sensation. First of all, let's say why. I mean, there hasn't been a bear sighted on Cape Cod since colonial times. So, you know, that alone was kind of remarkable. And then it was more public than people expected, and certainly in the end, more public than wildlife officials really could sustain. Mm-hmm. So it had traveled, first spotted, I think, in West Barnstable. It was suspected to have swum across the canal in Sandwich, although no one witnessed
this. Really knows,
you know, we don't know for sure. Ended up, traveling. And most experts said this poor bear was looking for love, and clearly in all the wrong places, because kept moving and moving and moving, and eventually got out to the Outer Cape. And as we all know, the geography of the Outer Cape gets narrower, smaller, more congested when you get to P-Town, and that's where the bear was. And that's where wildlife officials essentially made the decision after about 14 days, or actually shorter than 14 days, it was 14 days that the bear was out there, that they had to do something. Mm-hmm. At first they thought, well, we'll just leave it alone. I mean, you know, there are animals out there, you know, no one, they're coyotes and what have you. There's all sorts of animals in the woods on the Cape. But when they realized that this bear was interacting a little too much with people spotting it at the dump, I think it was near Pilgrim Monument at one point, they started to set traps. And literally they were putting donuts in front of bear-safe traps. Eventually it took a scramble in the woods in Wellfleet, where they tracked this bear down in essentially a briar patch, tranked it, and brought it out to Western Mass. So,
where we hope the bear found love.
We hope. Well, actually, remember.
Maybe back.
Remember, the bear actually tried to, well, I don't know if it was trying to get back to the Cape, but left its secluded spot a little further west and was spotted about a month later in Brookline, Mass.
Yeah.
And in a very congested area, climbed up a tree. I think it was about 60 feet. They tranked it again, fell out of the tree, and they brought it out to the woods. Yeah. So we're wondering if the black bear will be back next summer. We're certainly hoping.
Of course, then we have the sharks, which we're seeing more great white sharks, and we had the man visiting from Colorado who was actually bitten.
We've talked for a couple summers as more and more sharks have appeared from Chatham to the Outer Cape. And, the sharks obviously are interested in the seals, but we've wondered, as we've seen more sharks and they've been closer to swimmers, when we'd have a human interaction. And, of course, that happened this summer out in Ballston Beach in Truro. A gentleman by the name of Chris Meyer from, I think it was Colorado, was swimming with his son, was bitten on the leg by a shark. Fortunately for him, he got away, swam to shore, but he was very seriously hurt. And you know, as experts will tell us, and we understand, the sharks really aren't interested in the people, but mistakes happen, and the sharks are interested in eating. So if you're out swimming, as these folks were, fairly near seals, that's bad news. Or swimming really anywhere where the sharks are known to frequent. This is a story, of course, that's going to continue for some time, because it went from sort of the lone wolf shark out there to now a bunch, and now to almost chronically, everywhere from Lighthouse Beach in and around Monomoy, and now stretching up as far as Truro. So they're spreading
and
their
And that's
reef.
A good point you make, too, Paul, about you know, these interactions. Sharks are not necessarily interested in people, but with the seals in particular, we had a couple of sightings out here off Nantucket.
Right.
A number of those sharks that seem to be congregating around the Cape were crossing the Sound to south of Chatham, coming to Great Point, where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of seals have been congregating for the last couple of years. And a very popular fishing spot, fortunately not a very popular fishing spot on Nantucket, but you know, again, when you have some great whites and a smorgasbord of seal right there, your concern is that there will be an accidental interaction that could be dangerous or in fact tragic out here. Toward the end of the summer, we had a number of witnesses spotted, fortunately not a human shark interaction, but a pretty gruesome shark attack on a seal. Watched a shark come up from beneath the seal and pretty much knock it right out of the water, drag it back down again, and multiple witnesses saw this, definitely a confirmed sighting. With so many seals out there, a very, you know, a favorable meal for great whites in particular, there's been all kinds of discussion about seal abatement and seal control. Obviously, seals are marine mammals, are protected under their federal Marine Mammal Protection Act, but their population is getting to a point, some experts and certainly some fishermen say, that maybe there could be some kind of addendum or modification to the Marine Mammal Protection Act that would allow for some type of abatement of the seals in and around Nantucket, you know, Monomoy, Great Point, that would sort of even the balance again between, for fishermen, for sharks, for swimmers, and for the seals.
And you can bet that folks around here are looking to examples elsewhere, in certainly Australia and Florida and California. We're seeing this, and so we're going to have to take lessons from them.
Yeah, we just got less than a couple minutes left, and I want to mention, of course, we had an election, but the primary perhaps had one of the biggest upsets as Demetrius Atsalas, who served 14 years as a state rep in the 2nd Barnesville District, lost his seat to his Democratic challenger, Brian Mantle. That was sort of the big story around here. But the big story, economy. We're all talking about the economy. And so kind of looking, going into 2013, Josh, we're seeing some improvements.
I think the catchphrase perhaps in 2012 might be cautious optimism. Out here on Nantucket in particular, it was a very good year for real estate, one of the primary engines that drives our economy out here, real estate, hospitality to some degree, construction. I just got some numbers in for the year-to-date through December 1st, and then some projections. It looks like Nantucket's real estate economy might generate about $800 million in total dollar volume. That's the best it's been in 5 or 6 years.
That's good news.
Yeah.
When we're out of time.
We're hoping.
Yeah, so we're hoping that, that's true elsewhere as well. Josh Balling, managing editor at the Enquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh. Paul Pronovo, editor at the Cape Cod Times. Thank you.
Thanks, thank you. Happy New Year.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.